I'm Brandon Sedloff, the host of the Distribution Podcast. I've been humbled by your support. Every day, I get emails, text messages, LinkedIn messages from listeners around the world. I started this podcast a little over a year and a half ago as a way to codify and share interesting conversations that I'm having with industry leaders across private markets. I figured I'm very fortunate that I get to have these conversations, and every time I learn so much, so I might as well hit record, create a platform so that I can share the learnings with all of you. None of this would be possible without the support of Juniper Square. For the last 10 years, Juniper Square has been powering the investment operations of private markets across real estate, private equity, venture capital, crypto, and more. And Juniper Square's earned the trust of more than 2,000 investment managers around the world that we support with a global team of nearly 600 across our fund administration and technology businesses. If you have a fund that you're thinking about launching, have a fund administrator that you work with that's not meeting your needs, or maybe you just want to learn more about what it would look like to outsource some of these functions for the very first time, but you also want to ensure that you're maximizing the efficiency of your business and you're creating a leading world-class experience for your investors, then drop me a line, brandon_thedistribution@junipersquare.com, and I'll personally make sure a member of our team gets in touch. Thank you for listening and for your support of this podcast, and enjoy the episode. How has the amenitization of these premier office assets changed kind of post-pandemic? And what are tenants expecting today that they, you know, perhaps weren't expecting previously in a premier asset?
Actually, the most important one is access to transit. Now, there's not much you can do about that, you know, depending on where your building is. But that's what everybody's focused on, right? How hard is it to get to the office, and is the commute worth it? You know, that you hear that question a lot more. And that's why you see, you know, the vacancy rate on Park Avenue near Grand Central is like 8%. I think it's the strongest office market in the country because it's near great transit.
Welcome to The Distribution by Juniper Square. I'm your host, Brandon Sedloff. On today's episode, I sit down with Owen Thomas, Chairman and CEO of BXP, the largest publicly traded developer, owner, and manager of premier workspaces in the United States. On this episode, we go deep into Owen's career, which includes stops as the CEO of Morgan Stanley's Asia business and the chairman of Lehman Brothers Holdings, the group responsible for divesting the assets of Lehman Brothers post-bankruptcy, as well as his current role at the helm of BXP. We dig into the demand drivers of the office market, demystify the headlines, and discuss the future of office. Let's get into it. Owen, welcome to the show.
Brandon, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
It's great to see you. For those of our guests that don't know you, can you briefly introduce yourself?
Of course. Yeah, I'm the chairman and CEO of BXP, formerly known as Boston Properties, which is the largest public company that owns office, or primarily owns office buildings in the United States.
Well, you've already taken us there. We're going to spend a decent amount of time today talking about what's actually happening and demystifying the office market. But before we do, I've had the opportunity to know you for many years. We met first in Hong Kong. Would love just to go back a little bit earlier in your career, because you've had a very long career in the real estate business. And how did you get started in the business? And then, you know, let's talk about the journey that's led you to BXP.
Sure. Yeah. You know, there's lots of different places we could go with that. But I actually have to credit my dad with getting me in the real estate business. I grew up on a dairy farm near Stanton, Virginia, in the Shenandoah Valley. And my father, in addition to owning the farm and running a dairy farm, he also had a real estate business. And he was a trusted person to many of the other farmers in the area. And so whenever they wanted to sell their properties, they hired him as their agent slash broker. And he built this business up. And then he had a number of salespeople in his office that focused more on residential in the area. And when I was in prep school and in college, a couple of the summers, I worked for him in the office, you know, doing various tasks, you know, going to the county office, looking up deed information, all kinds of things. And it just, I think it kind of planted the seed. But I did some other things until I figured out that that seed was actually germinating. I liked math and science in high school, so I studied engineering in college. And I worked as an engineer for a couple of years before I went to business school. But in business school, another important step for me is I took a real estate class from a well-known professor, Bill Pourvu, and that really kind of reignited my interest in real estate. And I said to myself, look, I should do this. You know, I like it. And, engineering could be helpful because there's lots of physical things that go on in real estate. And obviously, all the logic and the math is important in real estate, too. So, I worked hard on it and ultimately got a job as an associate at Morgan Stanley's real estate group. And, worked my way up through that for many years. I think it was 1987 to 2005. And then I was on the firm's management committee, and I did some other leadership jobs for the firm. Like I ran the asset management division globally. And then when you and I met, I was living in Hong Kong, and I was the CEO of Morgan Stanley Asia, the firm, not just the real estate department. And then I left in 2010, and I became the chairman of Lehman Holdings, which was the company that emerged from bankruptcy that owned a lot of Lehman Brothers illiquid assets. And we had a really terrific group of people. Seven of us were on that board and stewarded that process. And then I joined here at BXP in 2013 as the CEO.
Well, okay. You make it sound so simple, and you glossed over a few of these major roles. So I think you mentioned that you ran the real asset management division globally. What did that look like? A lot of people know Morgan Stanley as MESREF or, the investment banking division, which I think is separate. Kind of what was your remit at the time?
Yeah, well, this wasn't real estate. Actually, when I went into it originally, there was no real estate other than securities. So, the firm run by Ted Bigman had a large real estate securities business, but this was Morgan Stanley's business that did asset management, in primarily the public markets. And I can't remember the exact numbers, but we had something like, $400 or $500 billion under management. And we had, the Morgan Stanley mutual funds and the Van Kampen mutual funds. And a lot of what we did during my 3 years there is we tried to build our alternatives business. We bought stakes in hedge funds. We started a private equity business, an infrastructure business. We brought the real estate into asset management, and we built up that part of it.
And at what point did you either begin to focus more on real estate, or would you say throughout your career, you've been more of a generalist? Kind of, I know you as a leader in the real estate space, but how would you kind of crystallize your experiences from Morgan Stanley onward?
Yeah, well, up until 2005, I did real estate, first as a banker, then as exclusively as an investor. And then at that time, the banking and the investing was together, and I ran both of it together. And then after that, I took these more general leadership roles at the firm that, real estate was part of it, but it really wasn't the big driver. And those were interesting, and I learned a lot, and it was a wonderful experience. Being in Asia was just a tremendous experience for me and my family. But then when I had spent 24 years at Morgan Stanley, and after I left, this Lehman role came along, and that was interesting. And a lot of that was real estate because we sold, it was the largest asset category that Lehman owned. And we did some interesting deals like selling the Archstone company. And when the Boston Properties or BXP opportunity, when I was made aware of it, it appealed to me because I it obviously had a leadership aspect. I was going to be working for a board, not a person. The buck stops with me, which I like. And it was all real estate. And also it was a little bit of a different role from what I was doing before, because when I was doing investment management real estate at Morgan Stanley, we were allocating capital. We were not managers. We would invest in development projects, but usually with a partner that did the real estate work. But here at BXP, that's not the case. So I get to do not only the investment work, things to buy, things to develop, the capital allocation, but we also, we're a fully integrated real estate company. So I actually spent a lot of time looking at development projects, assessing them, working with clients, tenants on new leases, existing problems, all that kind of thing. So the role clearly has a financial investment aspect to it, but it's also very much got a operational and actually an engineering aspect to it as well.
Interesting. And what year did you move to Hong Kong with Morgan Stanley?
I went in 2008, and I was there 2008, beginning of 2008. And I think I actually left the firm in June of 2011.
Okay. So that was around the same time that I got there. And that was, you know, kind of just after the collapse of Lehman in 2007. And I'm just curious, you know, you've been through a number of these cycles from a banking perspective, whether it's the dot-com, the GFC, COVID, you know, kind of from your perspective, how do these major kind of events compare or contrast to one another? Do you believe that where we are right now from a economy perspective is kind of similar? You can see patterns with these past periods of tumult, or is this something unique and different?
Yeah, I think, look, the business is cyclical. It always has been. It always will be. Interest rates are a huge driver of that. So that's the same. But what's different is what drives the cycles. So, you know, the big ones that I've been involved in were 1991. There was a small one in 2000, but I wouldn't put that in the same category. Then the GFC in 2008, 2009, and now we have the what I call the pandemic downturn. So, and I think they're all different. 91 was very much a supply issue. There was a lot of incentives put in place by cities and some financial incentives, and there was a lot of development going on. You know, banks were putting on assets, lots of speculative development. And so when demand dropped off because there was a recession, the market had way too much supply, and it created this whole RTC crisis, created lots of investment opportunities. And then 2008, I think, was driven more by leverage. You know, there was a lot of leverage in the system. A lot of buildings would have, I don't know if you recall this, but it's less complicated today. Back then, you know, buildings would often have like three or four levels of mezzanine financing behind a first mortgage. And so when business slowed down, you know, a lot of buildings and assets and companies went bankrupt or certainly had to be restructured because of all the leverage that was in place. And then today, I think it's more of a demand issue. So we've had, and I'm sure we'll talk about this some more, we've got this work from home challenge, which is a challenge for office, but it's also a challenge for cities, you know, and all the retail and businesses that are reliant upon traffic on the street. And then I think the other thing that's not well understood, because, you know, all these GDP numbers are strong and job creation numbers are strong, but since the middle of 22, when the Fed started raising interest rates, corporate earnings growth has been tepid. It was actually zero in 2023. The S&P 500 earnings on average was no growth. And when companies aren't growing their earnings, they're trying to figure out how to cut costs, not add them. So leasing slows down. And when you look into those job numbers that you see every month, that say 150, 250, et cetera, it seems like a lot of jobs. But when you go and look at where those jobs are, they're generally not in office using categories. You know, that's government, healthcare, travel, things like that, not information services, financial services, or business services is where all the office jobs are. So I think this cycle, to answer your question, is a little bit more of a demand problem.
Interesting. Well, yes, we'll absolutely come back. I have 100 questions to ask you about the office market to help us demystify what's actually happening. But before we go there, so I don't know the right way to ask this question, but you're the first banking executive that I've had on the show. And I guess the simple question is, what was it like to be the CEO of one of the world's largest banks in one of the most important regions at one of the most critical times in the development of said region, being Asia? I mean, how would you describe that experience?
Well, I loved it. I mean, it was, you know, Asia, the first thing I would say is when you talk about Asia, it is so far from being one country, right? I mean, you know this. I covered, you know, Japan, China, India, Australia. I mean, yeah, it's all in the continent of Asia, but the cultural differences could not have been more stark. So just that whole understanding all these countries are trying to and appreciate the local culture and learning about that. I love that aspect. I think also, you know, it was a matrix structure. So, you know, that's very important in thinking about a bank. So a lot of the divisions of the firm that committed capital, they were centrally run, you know, primarily out of New York. And the job of regional leadership was more to make sure that everyone was integrated, the country heads all reported to me, and that we were being culturally sensitive, and that all the various parts of the firm were working in a coordinated fashion. The businesses that had less capital commitment, that were more client-facing, those operated much more regionally. And so I was probably a little bit more involved in those aspects than in the businesses that were committing capital and centrally controlled. But, you know, it kind of every situation was different. You know, we had a fantastic team and franchise in Asia, which was great. You know, I felt like we had, you know, great connectivity, notwithstanding we were an American bank into local business. And then every country, you know, we had different priorities of what we were trying to do. So, for example, when I was there, probably the number one thing that happened was the global financial crisis. And it was particularly interesting in Asia for Morgan Stanley, because one of the ways that Morgan Stanley got through the crisis is MUFG, which is Mitsubishi's banking arm, bought a 20% stake in the bank. And I was in Asia when that happened. So I spent a lot of time in Tokyo with our partners or our owners at MUFG, and we were working on setting up partnerships in ways that we could work together in the Asian region. And it was, you know, very interesting to be, you know, at Morgan Stanley in Asia at that time because of that relationship. You know, another thing that was going on is the firm, up until within a year or two before I got there, had conducted most of its business in India through a joint venture, which was unwound. So a lot of what we were doing is restaffing our Indian business and getting local licensing and things like that. So, you know, it's kind of hard to generalize. Every country we had different, you know, priorities going on, but that was part of the joy of the work. It was varied depending on the country and what was required at the time.
Yeah, no, I think that's a very appropriate comment. Everybody generalizes and says Asia, but in fact, it's not a monolithic structure. You left Morgan Stanley after 24 years. How did you know, kind of, why did you leave, and did you have a sense of what was next at the time? Because it sounds like you came into a really interesting opportunity at Lehman. Was that kind of intentional and premeditated, or was it more kind of serendipitous?
No, the Lehman thing was definitely not premeditated. You know, I had been at Morgan Stanley for 24 years, and when I went to Asia, I promised, you know, that I would go for at least 3 years. And our oldest child was entering high school. You know, all my kids went to the American school, and, you know, the youngest was, I think, 4 when we went over there. But the oldest was entering high school the year I left, and my wife and I just felt like we loved being in Asia, but we weren't going to stay there forever, and we didn't want to disrupt, you know, any of our kids' high schools. And so we thought it was the right time to come home. And, you know, Morgan Stanley didn't have an equivalent job, you know, for me back in the U.S., which is fine. And, you know, 24 years was a great run, and it was a wonderful professional experience. And I was excited to see what was next. But I did not know what that was going to be.
How did the Lehman opportunity present itself?
So when I left Morgan Stanley, you know, I sent out an email to, you know, my friends in the, just broadly in industry, and one of them ran a hedge fund that was a primary creditor to Lehman. And he called me and said, look, I've got the perfect job for you. And so I went and met with them. And, you know, at first when I heard Lehman, that was, you know, my initial gut reaction was, you know, that's not something I'm going to be interested in. But once I understood what exactly it was, in other words, this was the Lehman aftermath. It wasn't, you know, the Lehman Brothers company. I thought it was going to be a fascinating project. I mean, I'll just give you some numbers. So the Lehman Holdings, which is the parent company of Lehman, there were $1 trillion of claims put into that estate. And it was the largest bankruptcy in world history. And then the asset side, you know, ended up being worth, you know, over $100 billion of assets that we ended up securing and then ultimately monetizing. So it was a major project. You know, real estate was part of it, but we had, you know, derivatives, contracts, loans, private equity investments. We had all these investments in these foreign subsidiaries. It was a super complicated process. I learned a lot. And also just the people that were involved. There are six other directors. They're, you know, all brilliant people from different backgrounds. And we've all become, you know, very close friends in addition to colleagues on this board. You know, we had a lot of shared mission and a lot of late nights, you know, figuring out a lot of tough problems. But it was, we still meet, by the way. The estate is greatly diminished, but we've still got several hundred million dollars of issues that we're trying to resolve on behalf of all the stakeholders. So it was a fascinating project. It also, for me, I think was a nice stepping stone back to the U.S. because, you know, I'd been in, even though I'd run global businesses, you know, I was based in New York and I'd been in Asia and away for, you know, 3.5 years, 4 years when you included my garden leave. So it was kind of a nice stepping stone back into U.S. business because of all the different things that we touched.
Yeah, certainly get your hands in a lot of different your tentacles in a lot of different pots in that role. How long did that last? How many years was that project?
Well, we started in March of we officially, I think we were appointed in December or January, December 2011 or January 2012. And officially our duties began in March of 2012. And, you know, we continue to work on it to this day with the same board. So, again, the job today is nothing close. I mean, again, we started with, you know, the claims have been largely resolved and the assets have gone from, you know, over $100 billion down to, you know, several hundred million dollars. But there's still a couple issues out there. And, you know, we meet periodically to try to work through them with our management team.
Oh, I look forward to reading the book one day that I'm sure you'll write in that chapter. If you know, just to give us a little teaser, if there was something that surprised you the most about your experience chairing the board, what was most surprising to you that, you know, differed from how you anticipated to be when you took on the project?
You know, having worked at an investment bank that is going well, and all the agreements that you sign and things that you do and the structures that are in place that you pay attention to, but maybe not as much as you would if you thought things were going to go south. And then when you look at Lehman, the complexity that's involved with different securities that got issued and all of the foreign subsidiaries and all the complexity on how that gets resolved. How is this get resolved in a bankruptcy, you know, that dictate how a derivative contract resolves itself? It's amazingly vague to me, you know, and requires a lot of court time and legal conflict, which you would think wouldn't be there. So I think that's, you know, the underlying complexity that exists when something of that scale ends up liquidating.
Fascinating. Well, so that chapter came, you know, it's still open, but has largely closed. And now you're the chairman and CEO of BXP. Remind me, how did you come into this role? Did you have a pre-existing relationship? You know, BXP, formerly known as Boston Properties, the preeminent office owner in this country. How'd you find the job, or how'd the job find you?
Yeah. So I, Morgan Stanley did business with then Boston Properties. And I had met Mort Zuckerman on several occasions. And also I had met Ed Lindy once when in Boston. But I wouldn't say that I was close to Ed, by the way, had passed away by the time I got involved. And Mort, you know, I knew him and I think he remembered me, but it wasn't like we were close. So, but, you know, Mort was in his 70s and he was the chair and CEO of an S&P 500 company. And I think he and the board recognized that, you know, they needed a succession plan. And an attorney of his that I also knew suggested me. And Mort and I, you know, met multiple times, and then I met the directors, and, you know, everybody got comfortable, and, you know, I started in April 2013.
I'm sure the last thing on your mind was a global pandemic that would shake the office market to its core. So let's dive into kind of where are we?
Always, Brandon, something's always going to happen. I mean, you know, the trees don't grow to the sky. The weather's not always blue skies. So you just have to be ready. You know, I always say, you know, my job, it's great if you can time things, and but, you know, you really, your job is to make sure that your organization is ready for lots of different environments, because that's what you're going to face.
So let's talk about that. So what did that mean for you? What is getting, being ready mean to you as a chairman and CEO of BXP? And, you know, let's take that forward to today and, you know, talk a little bit about how the business is adapting to the shifting environment. So maybe, you know, just to ask a more poignant question, where are we today in the office market? You mentioned there's a lot of myths, there's a lot of headlines. Give us your kind of overview of the state of play in, you know, June of 2024.
I mean, you kind of asked two questions there. One is, you know, what does it mean to be ready? And then second, you know, what's going on in the office? So I think, you know, you need to have a strategy that works, and you need to be able to survive in a difficult economic environment. And so what that means for BXP, and, you know, Mort simply always stated, you know, we want the best buildings in the best markets. And we've lived that and are consistently lived that. We've expanded it out a little bit, and we do life science now and housing, and, you know, and we've expanded out our definitions of what best is. Because actually, by the way, market in his mind was a city, but in my view, you have to break that down further, because even in cities, there's some areas that do really well and others that don't. So when you think about markets, it has to be submarkets. So I think that's really served us well. I think we have the right strategy in office, which is the best buildings in the best areas. And then the second is you need to be able to live through everything, and that's keeping your leverage low. You know, that is a really key factor for, you know, any company, and particularly a property company, because, you know, you want to, when times are good, there's a big temptation to use more leverage and to do more business, because that's the way that you grow your earnings. But if you have too much leverage when things go south, you could get in trouble. So I think it's being disciplined when things are going well, so that when things are not well, you're not stuck with too much leverage. And, you know, we did that as well. But to come back to the office market, what happened during this COVID matter has had several phases. So phase one was in March of 2020, we all went home and nobody was using their office because legally they couldn't. And the discussions that were going on in the first half of 2020 with clients was, well, they were saying, well, do I need to pay rent anymore? Because the government's not letting me use the space. And that was obviously a little unsettling to us. But when you get into how leases read, that's not the way they read. So so that we cleared off that issue pretty quickly. And then, you know, there was so much stimulus put into the economy that even though people generally weren't coming back to the office very much in the second half of 20 or even in 2021, there was a ton of leasing going on, particularly by tech and life science companies, because they were, you know, the markets were going up, lots of money was going into life science. So there was a lot of leasing going on, and there weren't that many people back in the office. So, you know, that's what I always say. People say, well, Owen, you know, this leasing is related to people working from home. Well, that's a factor, but let's go back to 2020 and 21 when no one was in the office and there was a lot of leasing going on. So that was kind of phase two. And then phase three was the Fed figured out that the economy was overstimulated through fiscal and monetary policy, and it went into the most aggressive rate hiking cycle in its history between the summer of 2022 and the fourth quarter of 2023. And that just has a big impact on businesses, particularly real estate. But any business, when you have rates going up like that, if you have your own leverage, you're paying more for it. And because a lot of companies are financed floating rate. And even if you don't have leverage, you kind of wonder what's going to happen to your customers in that kind of environment. So you're cautious. So again, when you're an office, you know, we're not leasing apartments. We're not leasing self-storage centers. We don't have retail customers. Our customers are businesses. And so a business is not going to sign a lease, or they're going to try. They're not certainly not going to take more space if their earnings aren't growing or if they're concerned about the business environment. So that was kind of phase three, which is what we saw in when the interest rate hiking cycle started. So that was end of 22 and into 2023. So now I think we're in phase four. So phase four is, guess what? Earnings are starting to grow again. So 2023, no growth in S&P 500 earnings. First quarter of 2024, last time I checked, they're up 5.5%. And guess what? Our leasing has really taken off. So our we always report, you know, kind of our pipeline of letters of intent that are signed, of leases that we think will get signed. And that number was at the end of April, like 850,000 square feet. And by the end of May, it had doubled, you know, to 1.7 million square feet. And the pipeline coming into that had stayed more or less in the same level. So I feel like we're in the early stages here now of a demand recovery. And again, look, there are more people coming back to the office, and I can go through that. But I think it's primarily driven by this earnings growth issue. And I think that's what, you know, that's what I follow to try to figure out what the volume of leasing is going to be.
So when you think about the health of companies, they need space because they're growing. But how does that translate to kind of work from home, work from office policies that you're discussing with the executives of these large corporations who are trying to plan for, you know, 3 to 15 years out in the future?
Let me talk a little bit about what's going on with badge counts, and then we'll come back to this whole issue of the impact of work from home. So first of all, whenever the broad media cites office usage, they use this Kastle data information. And I don't think that's a fair or an accurate reflection of what's going on in premium buildings. You know, first of all, not many of the premium landlords even use Kastle systems. I don't think they disclose what buildings are in their subset. And they're also measuring it across the entire week, not on peak days. So we have 53 million feet. We have badge data for half of it. And what our data is telling us is in New York, Tuesday to Thursday, that we're back at pre-COVID usage, if not greater. And then in Boston, Tuesday to Thursday, it's probably at 85 to 90% of pre-COVID usage. And then in San Francisco, it is behind and it's about at 50%. And I think in New York, you know, Monday's starting to fill in now, and I do think Boston and San Francisco are growing slowly. So the return to office is happening. Kastle data doesn't accurately tell you exactly what's happening. So then coming to the more broad market and what the work from home impact is, I think we are a little bit insulated from the work from home for the following reason. We own primarily what we call premier workplaces, which are buildings that are in the top 10 to 15% of the buildings in any city. And they're the buildings that, you know, we get a premium rent for them. And they're the buildings where the larger kind of name brand corporations and all these different industry sectors want to be. And so what's happening is, I don't think there's any CEOs or very few CEOs out there that really love remote work. And many of them are concerned and frustrated by not being able to get their workforces back in the office. And one of the ways they're trying to correct that is not through sticks, like, you know, mandating it, but through carrots by having, you know, great space and great place. So when you chart, so what's happening is that companies are saying, look, we just have to spend more on our space, or maybe we'll take less space, but higher quality and spend the same rent. So the premier buildings are capturing market share from the rest of the market. And then the second thing is, I think the more long-term impact of work from home is with support staff. So what we're seeing in our own company and a lot of companies is the workers that are really remote are accounting, IS, HR, you know, like a big bank in New York. I'm gonna just summarize it and generalize it, but you know, they might have half their workers be, you know, bankers, traders, portfolio managers, front office. They all have a workstation and they're all expected to be there, you know, 4 or 5 days a week if they're not traveling for some other purpose. But then half of their workers are support areas. And those workers, I don't think there's an in-person office requirement unless their direct managers require it. And so they have shared workplaces, you know, pooling. So and they have, you know, say 1.8 employees per workstation. And so I think that's the other reason why there's been this flight to quality is that most of the B and C buildings house the support workers because the companies spend less money on space for that cohort. And that's why those buildings are more vacant. So if you look at the five CBDs where we operate, and if you pull out those top 10 to 15% of buildings, the asking rents are 54% higher than the rest of the market. There's been positive absorption over the last 3 years in that cohort versus very large negative absorption for everything else. And the direct vacancy is like 11 to 12% versus 18% for everything else. So there's a marked difference in performance. And by the way, that gap isn't closing. You know, a lot of people will tell me, well, Owen, this is going to close because people are going to buy these B and C buildings and they're going to undercut you in rents. And, you know, maybe, but we certainly haven't seen that yet because we're just not competing with a lot of these, you know, lower quality buildings in the markets where we operate.
Fascinating. I have a few clarifying questions. So badge count, that is people who have a badge to get into their office that go through a turnstile in the building or some other sensor?
Yeah. So we have in half of our buildings, we know how many workstations that each of our clients have, and then we can also monitor the badges that come in. So not by individual person, but by, you know, by company.
And why only, what's happening in the other half of the buildings? Is the technology not there or it's just a different setup?
So they're just, the market doesn't require a turnstile. You know, in other words, they're just open buildings. So we don't have turnstiles. And then some of the buildings, like we have a building here in New York that in 2020, there was an anchor tenant that takes like a big chunk of the building and they weren't in place. And so if I put them in the analysis, we would show New York being much higher today than in 2020, but the same store and comparison isn't really fair. So we just, you know, there's just not turnstiles. Like our buildings in Los Angeles, you know, we don't have turnstiles on those.
Got it. So you have no actual way you can use, you know, create assumptions and heuristics, but there's no like actual way of knowing every individual or the count of every individual that comes in. Interesting. And I thought your point on Castle data was interesting given, you know, there is a very big difference between premier office spaces and everything else. And so I guess, yeah, how do you...
I think the other thing on Castle, yes, you know, even in our buildings, if you level it out during the whole week, it's not at 100% full. But if your client is using all of their space 3 days a week, they need all that space.
So how do you define premier office space? You know, we hear a lot about, you know, the best assets are performing really well. BXP has many of those assets that are often referred to as top performing in the market. What makes them a premier asset or a, you know, are we still calling them grade A or is it premier is the new term? How do we think about that?
I don't use the grade A, B, C because I think everybody has different grades on these things. And I think that's just confusing. So this happened to us like 3 years ago. We said, look, we don't understand what's going on. You know, people aren't coming into the office. All the vacancy is going way up in all of our markets and our leasing is strong. So we went to CBRE Econometrics and we said, look, you should redo your research. And instead of saying, you know, in New York, you know, Midtown is X vacant, Midtown South is Y vacant, all that, what you ought to do is break it by quality as opposed to submarket, because then you're going to really understand what's happening in the market. And so then they asked the question, well, how do we define premier? And so we said, look, you have a industry leading leasing practice, go to those individuals and say, look, if you have a industry leading and and premium rent paying law firm, bank, asset manager, healthcare company, you know, you name it, and all the buildings in the market were empty, which ones would you show them? So, and that's, those are the ones we can be with. So that's how they picked. And, you know, the first set of data that we got from them, you know, it was probably like 10%, you know, 12% of the buildings and 17% of the space. And I think as they've evolved their thinking on this, you know, they've gotten even more, they've skinnied that list down even further and made it a little bit more rarefied. And then, you know, look, I think the other thing too, I've seen these studies done just on age, and age is important. You know, newer is better than older, but I can tell you here in New York, we get the highest rent in our oldest building, which is the General Motors building, because of where it is, how it was built, and how we nurture it, you know, through the amenities and upkeep. So age is a factor, but it's not the only factor.
When you talk about amenities, how has the amenitization of these premier office assets changed kind of post pandemic, and what are tenants expecting today that they, you know, perhaps weren't expecting previously in a premier asset?
Yeah, it's an important point, because I think to compete in this market, you need to up your offerings on the amenities. So I think the most important one is access to transit. Now, there's not much you can do about that, you know, depending on where your building is, but that's what everybody's focused on, right? How hard is it to get to the office, and is the commute worth it? You know, that you hear that question a lot more. And that's why you see, you know, the vacancy rate on Park Avenue near Grand Central is like 8%. I think it's the strongest office market in the country because it's near great transit, which, by the way, has been enhanced because now the Long Island Railroad comes into Grand Central Terminal right here in New York. So that's number one. Number two, I think, is meeting space. So, you know, traditionally a client would have their own conference rooms. They might have a board room. They might have a room big enough to hold all their staff. And what we've all figured out is that's inefficient, and the building should provide that, and that you can use it and order it when you want it, but instead of leasing it all the time, because it's more efficient for them. And so, like, we did a major renovation, or built a floor at the General Motors building called Savoy Club. And I think, I mean, you could argue, but I think the most important amenity we put in there was a very significant meeting space. So if somebody wanted to have a board meeting, they could have it in a smaller room. Or if somebody wanted to have an all hands meeting with hundreds of employees, they could do that too. And it could be catered, and it could be wonderful. So I think that's number two. And then when you get beyond that, I think it's very location specific. So like at GM, there's not many, I would say, economic food options in that neighborhood, because it's on the Upper East Side, and it's, or the lower Upper East Side, and it's near Grand Central, or near Central Park. And so one of the things we put in Savoy Club was grab and go food, because in the GM building, there's senior people and then there are not senior people, and they appreciate, you know, that more value oriented and, you know, high quality food offering. So some buildings wouldn't require that. So, you know, we built here at 53rd and Lex, at 601 Lexington Avenue, we built a food hall called The Hue. And it's very popular with all of our clients in the three buildings we own at this location. So we wouldn't need to put any grab and go food or anything like that in any of these buildings, because that food option is there. And in some other neighborhoods that we might be operating in, that food might be just offered in another building nearby. It's just not something the building needs to do. And then I think the other one is fitness. And the same thing applies. If there's a good gym in the neighborhood, there's no reason to put one in your building. But if you don't have that, you know, you probably should add it. So I think those are the kinds of things. And then I think, you know, nurturing the street life in your neighborhood, and, you know, making sure everything is clean as it can be and safe. You know, that's obviously very important. I mean, we're partners with our cities and all that, but all of our buildings have their own security. And, you know, I think that's very, very important in the cities where we operate. So that's another one that I would point to.
Interesting. Yeah, I was just in 601 Lexington a few weeks ago, and I went I think it's, you walk in, you go downstairs, right, to the Hue where there's that big, I mean, it was amazing the way it was curated, all the different options. I was blown away. And what I was most impressed with, I actually took a picture of it, I'll send it to you, was just the way that people were using the space. You know, there were some people down there having business lunches. There were some people on their laptops where they were maybe doing some work. There was people from the street like me who had come in to grab a coffee. So it was really interesting to see that kind of the office building was kind of the new city center, if you will, or the new place. And you mentioned earlier, you know, there's a connection between the health of the office market and the cities that they exist in. And I'm curious, like, how do you think about that dynamic of placemaking? And what is your role as an office owner and developer in the overall kind of economic health of a city? And how has that partnership either worked or failed in certain cities that you operate in?
Well, it's important. I always say that our success is capped at the success of the communities where we operate. You know, if they're failing, we're going to fail because people won't want to move to that city and they therefore won't want to lease space in our buildings. But if the city is going well and people want to live there and it's desirable for whatever reasons, employers are going to chase that talent, you know, into those cities, and our buildings will become more valued and more sought after. So I think it's critically important. You know, we engage extensively, you know, with both city and state officials in all of our regions, and try to help them do their jobs, which are challenging. And there are lots of different things that are important. I mean, I think the first one is security and safety. You know, I actually think in New York, the city does a good job on this. You know, it's New York City. It's huge. Bad things happen and they're tragic. But on a per capita basis, it's not as bad as many other cities in the country, and it's a constant battle. And I think New York is, I think there's more work to do, but I think I don't think the city is, quote, unsafe. You know, I personally take the subway everywhere in New York City, and I think most of the people that work at my company do the same thing. So I think security and safety is the same. You know, San Francisco, you know, they have a shortage of police officers in San Francisco. So we do things to try to help. You know, we were very supportive of Brooke Jenkins, who is the new DA in San Francisco, who's focused on law and order in the city. We thought it was very important that she got elected, and we obviously did everything we could to support her. We and a bunch of other business groups and the city restarted a Police Officer of the Month award in San Francisco, and we sponsor that with a number of other people to try to, again, show our appreciation for the police officers and the importance of everything that they do. So there are things like that that we do in all of our cities. We have at BXP very distinguished former police officers that actually work for our company to help us, you know, think through all those issues. So that's one. I think public transit is another. So, you know, kind of a little bit depends on the city. But certainly in a place like New York, public transportation is just critical. I mean, the density that we have here and the difficulty of getting around on the surface and some of the distances that our people come from, you know, public transit's important. I think that's very true in Boston and San Francisco as well. So I think that's another very important thing. One thing that we are increasingly focused on is housing. So, you know, affordable housing in our cities, that has an impact on us, right? If New York or other cities become unaffordable, young professionals won't be able to come to the cities, and then the employers won't be interested in it. And that's very aligned with the objectives of the elected officials as well. And so we actually was at a lunch here in this building with state and city elected officials, you know, talking about these kinds of issues yesterday and what are all the challenges associated with building housing in a place like New York, and why all of a sudden has it become so expensive and difficult. So I think we do our best to try to engage with our elected officials to try to explain all these things and try to give them ideas to help them accomplish their goals. So that engagement is very important. I mean, we do things at the federal level too. I'm a board member of the Real Estate Roundtable, and I don't want to just ignore all that, but I do think the city and state officials do have a more direct impact on our day-to-day operations.
Did I hear you correctly that you're also building affordable housing?
Well, we're not. I mean, we are building apartments in certain areas. Many of our projects were land that we own are mixed use. And so we do end up developing the housing part as well. We don't lease and manage it, but we develop it. But I do think in general in our cities, you know, I want to say it's kind of small A affordable housing. What I'm focused on is just getting more supply. I mean, I think that's the answer. And how do you do that? And I think there are lots of ways that can be done. I mean, I think tax breaks have to be part of it. I think city and state owned land, you know, and create incentives for developers to build on that land. New York just, I think also office conversions is a super obvious way to do it. And that's getting traction around the country, including in New York. And New York recently passed at the state level some provisions that it was either city or state level, or maybe both, some tax provisions that I think are going to be very helpful. That's like a 90% tax break for conversions that are launched in the next couple of years of office to residential, which if you think about it, make a ton of sense, right? There are lots of B and C, particularly C office buildings that are probably not going to be office buildings in the future. We need housing. Many of these buildings are located in great spots near transit. And, you know, the carbon footprint from converting is so much less than, you know, destroying and building from scratch. And I've toured some of the conversions that have been done here in New York, and they're terrific, really creative ideas. You know, these deep floors, people putting shafts in them and then taking that FAR and putting it at the top of the building. And there's some really impressive creativity that's gone into, you know, converting some of these buildings that a lot of people would just dismiss as not convertible. So I think these are all, you know, solutions to the problem.
You have assets in a lot of the innovation economies of the United States. You're in Boston, you know, New York, I would consider to be innovation, but also more diverse, San Francisco, Seattle. What's your take on kind of the overall health of the kind of technology sector through the lens? You know, you talked about corporate earnings, you know, obviously demand for space is follows strong earnings growth. It sounds like, what are you seeing as you look out over the next, you know, 12 to 24 months in general about kind of the innovation sectors, whether that's life sciences, technology? These are sectors that have been hit pretty hard by the economy and are starting to bounce back. But I presume you've got your pulse on what's going on there.
Well, Brandon, you touched on the strategy. I mean, we define the best markets as where the best talent is. So people with advanced degrees, particularly in technical areas, that's where we want to be. What are the deepest talent pools? Number one. And then number two, where are there more barriers to development? I mean, you could argue it's a lot easier to develop in New York today than it was 20 years ago. And that's true. But it's also a lot harder to develop in New York than it is in Texas, you know, it's just period, even today. So that's the strategy. I think that leasing away from technology and life science firms is pretty much close to where it was before COVID. I think it's, you know, people are taking space, upgrading their space, growing in many cases. So what's absent, the only thing that's absent is technology and life science, and both of those are important. And I think they're absent right now for different reasons. I think the technology firms took a lot of space and hired a lot of people in 21 and 22, back in that phase two that I talked about earlier. And it probably was too much, and they've been digesting that since interest rates went up. And in many cases, they've given back space to the market and let go employees, and they've been cutting costs to grow their earnings. And then in the case of life science, a little bit the same, but a little bit different. If you look at the private equity investing in life science, there was a real bulge, you know, in 21 and 22, and therefore a lot of space got absorbed. And then all of a sudden that stopped and interest rates went up. And a lot of these biotech firms, you know, they're zero coupon kind of investments. And so interest rates have a big impact on valuation. So a lot of those companies are being told, you know, keep doing what you're doing, but do more with less, you know, and watch the cash burn. So that's what's happening today. But I think my view, and I think that this is shared broadly, let's think together what's going to happen around the world and in this country in the next 10 years. where is the innovation going to be and the growth? I think it's going to be in technology and life science. So I think these companies ultimately will digest this space, and I think they'll be back and growing. And, you know, I'm confident in that. And that's why we want to be in those cities. I think this is just a point in time.
So we don't have that much time left, but I want to hit on sustainability, because I know that that's really important to you personally, as well as to BXP and everything that you do. And you mentioned it in the context of these office to resi conversions being more sustainable, but more broadly, how do you think about sustainability in the built environment, specifically with office buildings, and kind of what are you focused on changing at, you know, in the market and specifically through what you're doing at BXP?
I'm glad you asked me about this, because there's been a little bit of pushback, you know, in the country on sustainability, and I want to address all that. So first of all, I think the first thing I would say is I'm glad you asked me about sustainability and not ESG, because ESG is a strange term, because it describes three different things, completely different things in our company that are run by three different groups and have zero interaction with one another. So I don't know how that term got started and why it's used so much, but it's not really an accurate depiction of what's going on. So what I'm going to focus on is your question, which is the E, which is sustainability. And I want to also say, you know, we do this because it's the right thing to do, but it's also the smart thing to do. I think it's all got to come back right to serving the shareholder. And I think by being a leader in sustainability, that's what we're doing. And so why is that? Well, I think about it as what the four super important constituencies that we serve, what do they think about sustainability? What's important to them? So let's go through that. So first is customers. So our clients, there's no question that some of our clients don't really think about this yet, and it's not a big focus, but increasingly it is. We did a requirement from Wellington, for example, in suburban Boston, and they were very focused on the sustainability aspects of fulfilling this requirement. So the building that we put them into was an existing building. We put more insulation in it. So we didn't tear a building down and give them a new one. So, right, the embodied carbon impact of doing that was materially lower than a new construction. And then, you know, we put in all electric building systems, the most efficient equipment, and then we have on-site solar on the building and on the garage that powers, you know, their space. So they have a net zero scope 1 and 2 fulfillment, and that was really important to them. And we're in the process of trying to get off the ground a new project here in New York called 343 Madison. It's an all-electric building, and, you know, it's a big requirement, and new construction is expensive. And so I don't want to suggest that there are, you know, tens of companies coming to us wanting this space, but the clients that we do talk to about it, the sustainability part of it's important to them. And look, sadly, as climate change gets worse and these weather events get worse, I think more and more people are going to be focused on sustainability. And I think more of our clients are going to be focused on it. So we think it's important to be excellent in it and to have product offerings that are sustainable. And by the way, it's not just building new buildings. Like the GM building is an old building, but we recently put in a new chiller that's efficient, and we brought down the carbon footprint of that building materially. So you can make older buildings better from a sustainability standpoint as well. So that's the clients. The second is the communities. You know, where we are, almost every city we're in is coastal. You know, so they're dealing with sea level rise. They are generally democratic and more progressive cities. So they're very focused on sustainability. Given the expertise that we have, we'll often meet with city officials and help them think through how they should have, you know, what they should be doing to help, you know, make the cities more sustainable. A couple of our cities now have put in carbon taxes. We have local law 97 here in New York, where, you know, if your emissions per square foot exceed kilograms of carbon per square foot exceed certain levels on certain dates, you get fined. So we're, you know, staying way ahead of that. So our cities care about this, and they're fining us for having too much carbon emissions. So we got to get in front of that. capital providers. That's the third one. So we think today something around 7 to 8% of our shareholders, by not by number, but by percentage of the market cap of the company, are there because of sustainability. In other words, they're a sustainable fund. You know, that's a lot. And I think it's growing. So if you have that big of shareholder base that's focused on your sustainability performance, you got to pay attention to that. And on the debt side, you know, we have generally do green bond offerings, meaning that we're taking the capital and investing it in developments that are of green buildings. And, you know, when we started doing this, you know, 8 or 9 years ago, there wasn't really much impact to it. But today, there are a lot more investors that are focused on green issues only. And we think there is a pricing benefit, not huge, but, you know, we are big borrowers and, you know, we're a capital intensive business. So even a few basis points of savings is a lot of money. And so we're serving shareholders by having these green bond offerings. And then lastly, employees. You know, our employees, younger employees are more focused on this than older employees, but I think everybody is. And I think by being good at this, BXP is a more purposeful company. And I think it's easier for us to attract and retain talent when people are working for a company for something more than a paycheck. And I think being good at sustainability provides that to us.
If somebody's listening and they're saying, well, you know, isn't that nice? You're a huge company, public company. You have all these resources. I just don't know how to get started. And they throw their hands up in the air. Any advice to kind of taking that first step or getting started? Any key learnings that you can share? Because you've been on this journey for a long time.
Yeah, it doesn't really cost anything. Most of what we do, we like when you change your equipment to make it more sustainable and electric, you're saving money. Because your power, you know, our sustainability department, generally we say you can do whatever you want. You just got to get payback, you know, in, you know, some reasonable period of time. So I think it's, and there are lots of resources out there to help you. I mean, I'll pitch a little bit. Brandon and I are both super involved in ULI. There's a sustainability center. There's all kinds of public resources available to all kinds of landlords that want to understand equipment and systems that they can start to install to make their buildings more sustainable. So I think those resources are out there. And again, if you're replacing equipment that's reached its useful life, the end of its useful life, then it really doesn't cost you anything because you're going to be replacing it with something that's going to save you money. Yeah. By the way, a lot of these solar projects that we do in our suburban buildings, another company is building the solar array and we're just agreeing to an offtake agreement to buy power. We're not out the money. We just have the resources to go figure out how to do these projects. So it's a lot of work, but it's not necessarily a huge financial burden.
I know there's a lot more that you and I could talk about. Unfortunately, we're out of time for today, but I've really enjoyed the conversation. Most importantly, you know, understanding your career journey and demystifying some of what's happening in the office market. I learned a lot, and I'm sure our listeners did too. So thank you very much for joining me today.
Well, great, Brandon. It's great to be with you again. Thank you for having me today.
Thanks for listening to the latest episode of The Distribution by Juniper Square. If you liked today's podcast, please share it with a colleague or a friend. And don't forget to subscribe and rate The Distribution on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can connect with me on LinkedIn by going to www.linkedin.com/IN/B Sedloff, or you can find me on Twitter @B Sedloff. You can also find a video recording of this conversation on demand at junipersquare.com/the-distribution. Until next time.